I don't know. Is it different clothing? Could have packed light.
Packed light, yep.
Good morning. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the administrative law judge assigned by the Office of Administrative Hearings to this case. This hearing is on the application of Northern States Power for a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, which is PU 15175, for an EDP for the proposed Courtney Project Resource Edition, PU 15181, and PU 15183. The record will show it's a little past 8:30 a.m. on July 23rd, 2015. This is the time and place set by the Public Service Commission for this hearing. The commissioner's notice of hearing for this hearing consolidated the issues. The issues in case PU 15-175 are: one, whether public convenience and necessity require or will require the construction and operation of the public utility planner system, and two, whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide the service. The issue to be determined in case number PU 15-181 is whether NSP's proposed resource addition is prudent. The issues to be determined case number PU-15-183 are: one, whether the Courtney Wind Power Purchase Agreement Resource Addition determined to be prudent by the Commission February 26, 2014, its order accepting settlement in case number PU-13706 is no longer prudent. Two, whether the Commission's February 26, 2014 order adopting settlement in case number PU-13706 should be modified. Mr. Simpson, there was something else that you wanted to bring up.
Yes, Your Honor. As a preliminary matter, as part of the group of cases that the company has made application for, also includes case number PU-15-174. That's our application to transfer the site permit from Courtney Wind Farm LLC to the company itself. That was procedurally handled separately. A notice of opportunity was issued, and to our knowledge, no comments or requests for a hearing have been received. And because transfer of the site permit is a precondition for the company to construct the project and actually begin physical construction, should the commission choose to approve the other applications we're talking about today, we respectfully request that the commission also act on that case at the same time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, do you have a response to that question?
I have no objection to that, Your Honor.
Ms. Chefko-Tsaka?
No objection. Thank you.
We'll let the commissioners make that decision here as we go, but just so that's now on the record. I guess we'll have the council state your appearances for the record.
Zeviel Simser, Briggs & Morgan, on behalf of Northern States Power Company.
Allison Archer with Xcel Energy.
John Chu, on behalf of advocacy staff. Along with me today is Victor Shook, who will be testifying.
Lana Jeffcoat-Sacco for advisory staff, and along with me today is Jerry Lean.
Thank you very much. Looking around the room today, is there anyone present other than witnesses for NSP or the commission that might be testifying? It doesn't look like there is, so I'll skip that statement, and I'll move on to opening remarks from the commissioners. Commissioner Kalk, is this your portfolio?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. That was a pretty good joke you had starting it out. Very accurate. Thank everybody for coming today. Just a couple opening thoughts, Zev, so you can hit it in your testimony in case you hadn't thought of it. This is a little bit different because we're going to be potentially backing out of the power purchase agreement and all that. So just want to make sure that we can make sure a good thing on the record today of how procedurally we can get that all taken care of, potentially backing out of that, making sure the rate case, all the paperwork is taken care of, because this will then be part of the rate case settlement. And there's a lot of procedural issues in this case that I haven't seen before. So that for all the councils out there, just make sure we dot the I's and cross the T's on all this one, because it is kind of complicated as we do all that. We were talking a couple days ago about how Minnesota law has certain things in place. Well, North Dakota law says rebuttable presumption on something you're going to own. So to me, that's a big factor right away that tilts this in your favor, because there's a different kind of standard that we'd look at than an ADP on something outside of the state. So we have our own laws that guide things a certain way. Also, in the hearing when we did the citing on this for the company that you had previously signed the PPP with, we asked a lot of questions about decommissioning. So now that you're going to own this resource potentially, North Dakota law also says that after 10 years, we may require some type of financial assurances. The three of us have started doing that. So, and I've said in the wind farms that we've required financial assurances, we've done different things, but we haven't crossed the bridge at how an investor-owned would do it. And I think you probably have ways you can do it accounting-wise and all that. But if you could walk through how that would be different, or how you're going to handle the decommissioning, potentially if we ask for some financial assurances or a plan on how you'll do that. And then finally, my last thing is that long before I got to the commission, the commissioners have been roughing up Xcel Energy about actually owning something and building something in North Dakota. So MDU owns wind farms in North Dakota, Otter Tail does, so I'm hopeful we can find a path forward that keeps the cost down on something and actually gets you guys to build something here. So thank you for being here today.
Chairman Fedorchak.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank Commissioner Kalk for pointing out all the procedural issues. I think those are important. I don't have any real significant concerns on this project from the get-go. I just look forward to a good, thorough discussion of the what you all see as the benefits, what advocacy staff has identified as some of the strengths and or weaknesses of this project, and a full discussion of the facts in this case. So thank you.
Commissioner Christman.
Commissioner Kalk covered some of what I was going to say regarding the decommissioning, covered it well, so I'll just leave that at where he left it. The only other thing I'll just add is I guess I just want to say that I come into this with a bit of a skeptical eye, you know, and this is one of several wind projects where it's almost like we go racing out to a siting hearing in a fire truck because it's such a hurry and everything is in place and the agreements are made and the money's there and we're ready to go. We have to get this built and man, we need it not tomorrow, but today we need all the approvals. And years later, we're still making changes. And so while everything can be prettied up pretty well, you wonder what you're missing or why behind the scenes if it's such a good thing, why it's drug on this long and to what extent we're just cleaning up a mess. And so although the application, as I read it, things look pretty good, I just will say that I come in with a bit of a skeptical eye.
Council exhibits, so we don't stipulate two exhibits on the record?
Yes, Your Honor. The company and advocacy staff have stipulated to the following exhibits on the record, which are the company's applications in the noticed cases, as well as the pre-filed testimony in the noticed cases, as well as the opening of Ms. Laura McCartan and the opening statement of Mr. Greg Ford. And I leave it to Mr. Hsu with respect to advocacy staff's exhibits.
So the NSP exhibits we have at this point are marked NSP 1, 1A, 2, 2A, 3, 4, 5, 5A, 6, 6A, 7, 7A, 8, and 9.
Yes, Your Honor, and those marked with an A are the trade secret versions.
Okay. Any objection to those exhibits, Mr. Hsu?
No objection, Your Honor.
Ms. Chepkut-Sacker, any objection to NSP's 9 exhibits?
No, sir.
All right, those will be received. Mr. Hsu.
Yes, Your Honor. I give you an exhibit list as well as a witness list. And on there we have three exhibits listed, PSC 1 through 3. The direct testimony, a FERC order establishing hearing settlement procedures. And PSC 3 is the revised second amended comprehensive settlement agreement. In addition to that, we like to add PSC exhibit 4, which I also, I believe, placed up there. And that's the advocacy staff's response in support to discontinue the Courtney Wind Purchase Power Agreement.
Mr. Simpson, any objection to those four exhibits?
No objections, Your Honor.
Okay, those will be received as well. Okay, Mr. Simpson, opening statements?
I'll keep it very brief, and Ms. McCartan will kick off the hearing, but we appreciate all the commissioners' time today. We're ready to call our first witness.
Okay. Mr. Hsu, opening statement.
Your Honor.
Ms. Chepkut-Sacker, any opening statement today?
No, sir. Thank you.
Okay. You can call your first witness.
Your Honor, just one preliminary thing. I would just like to request that the commission be able to take administrative notice of case 13706 as the previous ADP for the PPA according to one project.
Any objection?
We have no objection.
It'll be allowed, at least from my standpoint.
Your Honor, that does raise one thing in my mind as well, which is, should the commission approve our request to discontinue Prudence, the company does not believe any amendments or any other changes to the settlement agreement that was approved in that case are necessary to reflect that order, only that the order would be subsequent to it, and that's it.
And it seems to be agreed, Mr. Shute.
We can talk about some more, but at this point, I don't think I have to disagree with that.
Okay. Ms. Jeff Butzak?
I have no reason to disagree now, but I have to
take it.
Look at it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We can come back to that. All right. Any other order that we need to take care of before we call the first witness?
No, Your Honor.
Anybody? Mr. Shue?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Butzak. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Ms. McCart, take the stand. You're getting to be an old pro at this, but at least once for the record, I'd probably have to read this into the record. I'm required by law to advise you of the law regarding perjury in North Dakota. Perjury is defined as a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $10,000, or in some cases, both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
You may proceed. Mr. Simpson.
Ms. McCartan, I understand you have an opening statement.
I do.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you, Judge and Commissioners, for the opportunity to provide testimony in this case. I also want to thank Commission staff for their constructive engagement in this proceeding and this petition. In this proceeding, the company is requesting an advance determination of Prudence to purchase, develop, construct, and own and operate the 200-megawatt Courtenay Wind Farm project in Stutsman County, North Dakota. This commission initially approved the Courtenay project as a prudent power purchase agreement with developer Geronimo Wind Energy. However, the project became at risk of failing when Geronimo encountered financial difficulties and could not find a partner or developer under the PPA structure. The company undertook a comprehensive review of the Courtenay project and determined that it would be in the best interest of our customers for the company to assume ownership and self-development of this cost-effective project rather than let it fail. We are here today to ask the Commission to find that this new ownership structure is prudent. The Commission's advocacy staff and the company have similar views regarding the prudence of the Courtenay project. We both recognize that North Dakota law provides a presumption of prudence for generation resources located in North Dakota. We believe that our proposal to purchase the Courtenay project meets this presumption and is also prudent in its own right. As company witness Paul Johnson and staff agreed, the company's purchase of the Courtenay project is more cost-effective under all scenarios than canceling the project, and it compares favorably to the original PPA terms under virtually all sensitivities. The project also provides a hedge against future increases in natural gas prices, market energy costs, and carbon dioxide regulation. Finally, the company has taken several steps to effectively manage the risks that come with development and construction of a new generation resource. Overall, we thank staff for their thoughtful analysis and consideration of the multiple factors that support this purchase and development of the Courtenay project. In light of these factors, I believe the record supports a finding that this acquisition is prudent and respectfully request the Commission to grant an ADP. Thank you.
Mr. Simpson, questions?
The witness is available for cross.
Mr. Shue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, would another witness be better suited to ask about window measurements, Vestas, and the construction schedule?
Yes, I think the construction schedule would be a question for Mr. Ford.
As well as mitigation specifics?
Within the contractual, right. Yes, that would be Mr. Ford.
All
Have you already received a regulatory approval from the Minnesota Public Utility Commission?
This matter is scheduled to be heard by the Minnesota Public Utility Commission July 30th, I believe.
Okay. And
and I would just add that we have received favorable indications from in that arena as well.
Okay. And I was looking on the FERC docket, and there was, I believe, MISO filed to actually have default of the generation interconnection agreement. And the most recent filing that I believe I saw was MISO's response in support of curing that default. I was wondering if the FERC has actually ruled on that yet, or if you have any update on that.
I think there's two issues. There's the interconnection agreement, which I believe is approved.
Right.
And then there was an issue associated with transmission access, and we do have a settlement with Minn Kota that's pending, and we expect to be approved.
Okay. I think that's all the questions I have for Laura. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Jessica-Sacco.
Jack took my question, so I don't have any either.
Hey, Mr. Sensor, anything you want to follow up on yet?
Just to clarify the record briefly, Ms. McCartan, the MISO had filed to withdraw its notice of termination in the FERC proceeding, and the withdrawal is effective by FERC rule and operation of law. Is that correct?
I'm not a lawyer, so I really can't tell you the answer to that.
Okay. Perfect. No further questions.
Okay.
Commissioners, Commissioner Call.
Thank you, Your Honor. There must be a joke in there somewhere about attorneys, but I'm going to let it go.
I love my attorneys.
I know we all need them, correct? Okay. If there's something that gets into the trade secret, just, of course, let us know and we'll deal with that when it comes. I just want to walk through to Commissioner Crispin's point, because when I first saw this unfold, I thought the same thing. Like, this is just gets ridiculous. These companies come racing in here and they promise they can build things for half a cent a kilowatt, and then they can never get them off the ground. So how did it all unfold where the company that's going to be building it and selling you the power contacts you? You testified to it, but just kind of walk through practically how that unfolds.
And I can at a high level, Commissioner, and then I would direct also that our witness, Betsy Engelking, would be another resource for that. But at a high level, my understanding is that the Geronimo LLC did try to find equity partners so that they could proceed with the project. They found that the PPA price was not sufficient to attract equity investors, so I think
they had sold it too low a price than what people would actually be willing to invest in.
I suppose that's one way to look at it. Yeah, there were some assumptions they made about other tax provisions that they would be allowed to access that didn't come to fruition. I think they exhausted all their alternatives and came to us and said, if we can find a way to work with you, this project can continue. Otherwise, the project will not continue.
How does that work where they offer a selling price and they can't find people willing to invest in it, but you can then become the person that builds it and keep that price lower? Or the same price or lower? How does that, to me, it seems like it's going to pancake costs.
Commissioner, I think that those questions will have to go to our witness,
okay, that's fine.
Paul Johnson. But I think what we have gone through is that the price that we will actually incur, that our customers will incur, is very favorable to the initial terms of the PPA. So we were able to structure an agreement that had that outcome, so it's still good for our customers. All the particulars about what was different between the original structure that Geronimo put together versus what we are able to do as owner, I think Paul Johnson is the best person to answer that. But the bottom line is we can bring this resource on at a very favorable value to our customers, a cost savings.
So that Paul will flush all that out in his testimony?
Okay. Yes.
All righty then. I think you'd agreed to purchase the 200 megawatts of power. Had you not invested, to become the owner of it, would you have had to seek 200 megawatts of power somewhere else?
Commissioner, this project came about as a result of a an RFP that we did, I think, in early 2013, seeking what the market could provide for low-priced wind energy, and we found that the market provided, good access, and we went forward with those three projects because it was going to save our customers a lot of money. If we didn't go forward with this project, it's basically an energy resource for us. So we could potentially look for other projects that could provide comparable energy savings for our customers. We don't need it for capacity so much, but it is an energy resource that
by bringing it on, we lower our customers' costs. Not having it doesn't mean we don't have access to adequate energy, but by having it, we lower our customers' costs.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
I think it's my turn, Judge.
Okay. I didn't expect Commissioner Cox to finish so quickly.
Are you saying it's unlike him to be short-winded?
I'm pleasantly surprised.
I only ask questions if I have questions.
Oh, all right. Just a few questions for me, too, as well. Tell me about your company's experience owning versus owning wind farms versus going the PPA route. How many other wind farms does XL actually own?
I'm sorry, Commissioner, I don't know exactly. We do own some wind farms, but I think Paul Johnson could tell you exactly the number that we own and the capacity versus the amount we have, PPA contracts we have for wind farms.
Do you have a general, like 50%, or would you just prefer to wait to
have I think we own less of the total wind resource than we contract through PPAs, but I just don't know the breakdown.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the current status of the project? Where is the project today? Is it just on hold, or at what point do they have all the towers purchased and committed to? I mean, what's the status of the project?
Commissioner, I'll have to direct that question to Greg Ford is up to speed on all the status of the project, and I think Betsy Engelking could also answer some of the questions about what Geronimo has done with land acquisition, permits, and things of that sort locally. So between the two of them, I think they're the better resource for your question.
Then in general, from a management perspective, can you just speak to the advantages and disadvantages of owning versus a PPA?
Yes. In particular with this project, we're able to own this and deliver that resource and that energy to our customers at a very good price, very comparable to the PPA. As an owner, we also will secure the benefits of this project for longer than what a PPA term would be. So if a PPA term was 20 or 25 years, then you would be facing a renegotiation at that point or procuring a different resource. As the owner, we will be able to run this this facility for as long as it's economically viable and providing good value to our customers. So those are two things that I think are very valuable. As an owner, it's also part of our rate base, so there is a value to us there as well.
How so?
We are able to earn on rate base. So it becomes part of our asset, the total value of assets that we are able to earn on.
Okay. Then according to the charts that I saw in the tables on page 14, you actually save money owning versus going the PPA route. Is that correct? I think it's like a 30. Where did I see that? Maybe it's on this page. Table 3 on page 15.
Commissioner, is this with the application?
It is, yep.
Okay, let's see. My exhibits aren't numbered, so here we go. Application for...
It's actually page 15, table 3. If you can read it, it's awfully small print.
I'm maxed out at 3.0 cheaters, so let me see here. So I'm looking at table 3.
Yeah, and I really don't need cheaters yet, I promise you. Right, Commissioner Cobb? It shows to me that it's about $35 benefit to own it versus a PPA. Am I seeing that correctly? Or reading the chart correctly, the bottom line, own versus PPA, we save $35 million under the base.
I think that as this application mentions, that company ownership is more favorable compared to the PPA under all sensitivities other than the 20-year life sensitivity. So I think that's, in terms of looking at these exact numbers.
Okay, yeah.
That's what it is showing, conclusion. Yes.
And the 20-year life scenario. Talk to me a little bit about that, why that one isn't. You know, if the towers are, if they fail after 20 years and can't be used anymore, then this is not a good project to own?
Mr. I'll direct that question to Mr. Johnson.
All right. And then would he be the one to speak to why it's so much more favorable to own versus having the PPA?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then, no more questions for me. Thank you.
Just to be clear, Mr. Johnson will be taking the stand, correct?
That's correct, okay. Commissioner.
So my questions are for him, but I'll ask you, what's the construction plans?
Commissioner,
if assuming this is approved.
Generally, we would not begin construction until we received all required permits, the CPCN, the Certificate of Site Compatibility, and so forth. The construction schedule is tight so that we can get this in service and operating by the end of 2016 in order to take advantage of the 30% PTC. Further details I would direct to Mr. Ford.
What's the requirement for the 30% PTC that would be completed by the end of 2016?
Commissioner, as I understand it, there's a couple of factors that if you meet those factors, you can be qualified for that 30% PTC, and it may not be, I don't know that it's full completion and operation of the unit. I think perhaps Mr. Johnson knows the exact provisions of how the eligibility for the 30% PTC are written.
Okay. Who will be finding and hiring a contractor to do that work?
My understanding, Commissioner, is that we would intend to proceed with the contractor that Geronimo already has on board, which is a North Dakota contractor called Wanzek Construction. So we would keep that relationship if we are approved to take over ownership of this project.
I think the rest of my questions are for Mr. Johnson, really.
Okay. Mr. Simpson, any follow-up or redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Schiff?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat?
Nothing here, thank you.
Okay. Commissioners, anything else?
Nothing more
for me.
Thank you.
Ms. McCartan, thank you.
Thank you.
Can Mr. Simpson call your next witness?
The man everybody's been waiting for, Mr. Paul Johnson. Oh, no, let's go. Okay. Paul, why don't you come up? Paul.
All right.
Let's get all these issues out on the table and,
sure,
and then go from there.
Mr. Johnson, welcome back. Again, you've heard the perjury admonition this morning. You've heard it before, so I just ask you to raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Do.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson.
Mr. Johnson is available for cross.
Mr. Hsu.
Thank you, Your Honor. How is purchasing a distressed asset better than just developing the project outright from the beginning?
Well, in this situation, it resulted in a lower cost for us in terms of acquisition.
Okay, the acquisition resulted in a lower cost than if you had just had started from scratch.
As compared to the PPA that we currently have with for this project, yes.
Okay, what if we went back to the beginning, like when you first were signing this PPA and had developed it at that point in time? Would it have likely been a lower cost at that time to develop at that time?
I couldn't know for certain if that were the case because turbine prices and all of the costs associated with knowing for certain what those costs would be at that point in time would be unknown to me at this time.
Okay. Have the type of turbines changed from the PPA to this project here?
Well, initially the bid came in without a specific turbine being selected, and that's not uncommon for projects. And then since then, a specific turbine has been selected.
Okay. Can I turn your attention to page 15, I believe it was, of the application? That's it.
Excuse me, you're talking about the, Your Honor?
Sorry, Exhibit 1.
It's the ADP application, because there's another application, too.
So that'd be Exhibit 2, NSP-2.
Could you explain the net benefits of this project as opposed to the PPA using this chart for us?
Table 3?
Yes, please.
Okay. So I'm looking at the base case, all across the sensitivities there that were tested, there is a net benefit in all cases. In terms of the base case, $35 million net benefit compared to the PPA. We then applied sensitivities in terms of adjusting the increase in gas costs up and down, and it still preserves a substantial savings. We then looked at turning markets on and giving the system the benefit of purchasing market energy, and that also resulted in a net savings of $31 million. We then increased the operating life assumption by 5 years, and that resulted in an increase from the base to $44 million net benefit. We then pulled it back to a 20-year operating life, which was a net cost of $42 million. And then we adjusted the energy production, which is a very key factor in the economics as far as the capacity factor of the project. So increasing that by 5% gave it a substantial increase, going from 35 on base up to $60 million benefit, which is very significant. And then reducing, just to show the sensitivity to a reduction in output, it reduced that down to $9 million if you were to reduce that by 5%. Capital sensitivity, which included adding two different tiers of additional cost to the project to see how that would affect, and adding in sensitivity 1, $18 million was a net benefit. Increasing it further resulted in only a $1 million benefit. And then in terms of the ongoing cost assumptions for ongoing capital and O&M, increasing that by 25% had reduced the net benefit from 35 down to $14 million. And then the reduction, if there was to be a reduction of 25% in that assumption, that the net benefit would increase from 35 to $55 million. So in terms of planning language, this is a very robust conclusion, that when you have a base assumption and you test it against the obvious drivers that could have a dramatic impact on that result, and you see a positive result underneath that in all cases, that's a very solid and robust conclusion that this is a very cost-effective proposal.
Were decommissioning costs taken into consideration with this as well?
Yes, we have confirmed that those were included.
Okay. And I know there's a, and this might be a question for Mr. Ford, but there may be a need to expedite the process of construction that could lead to higher construction costs. Do you think that could materially affect this, the construction costs or the ongoing ownership costs or anything in that regard?
Well, I can't speak to the specific changes that might occur, but in terms of the sensitivities, we can still see that there's a significant net benefit if there were a cost increase.
And how long do you anticipate that these wind turbines will probably be in operation?
Well, our life assumption is 25 years.
25
which
years.
And that's backed by industry experience.
Okay. You don't have 25 years, obviously, in this chart. I was wondering if you could give us
25 years is
that would be the base?
Base case.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. If I could turn your attention to page, I think it's 12 of your testimony, that would be NSP Exhibit 5. Page 12?
Yep, I'm there.
Okay. All right, so there's initial cost increase, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and I was wondering if you could explain how we decrease down to, it looks like 2027. What is the cause for that decrease in cost?
It's primarily two driving forces, the depreciation and the benefit of the production tax credit.
Okay, and then 2027 is when you lose the production tax credit?
That is correct.
Okay, and then it follows again with depreciation and fuel costs that you...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What happens in 2042, out of curiosity?
I think that's the end of the time frame for the analysis for...
Thank you.
Yes, that's the end of the time frame for the analysis through 2040.
You modeled your line and congestion losses from MISO's 2012 ProMod model. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and is that common practice?
Yes, we defer to MISO, who really is capable and has that kind of nodal node to node differentials between sending power from one node to the other, and looking at the cost difference as a representation of congestion and losses. And that's what they most recently used as well to update their analysis as stated in testimony.
And I think attached to your testimony, that's where you attached the wind study that was done. Is that correct?
Yeah, we also have an updated one that reflects the current turbine and the expected output from that.
Okay. After that wind study, were any the turbine locations needing to be moved at all or changed?
I'm not really familiar with any on that. I would defer to Greg Ford on that.
Okay. Was that study important in your determination taking this project?
Well, of course, because now the project now had a specific turbine that had been decided for the project. They had done detailed analysis of those sites that were used for that performance analysis to determine the updated and project-specific turbine-specific expectation for output.
Could you explain the differences from what you found as opposed to what was previously found under the PPA?
Well, as I stated earlier, the proposal that came in was not turbine-specific, and so the analysis we did was based on their best representation of what they thought a reasonable capacity factor would be for that analysis, and that's what we used. And that's since been updated to be turbine-specific and represents a significant increase in output expectation.
Now, this project relies heavily on the production tax credit to be cost-effective, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako, questions?
Could you please repeat the capacity factor? We just missed it, Jerry and I.
The expected capacity factor is 46.1.
Yes. Thank you. That's all we have.
Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Paul, for your testimony. To follow up on what Ms. Jeff Kotsako did, 46.1, you've been doing wind stuff for a long time. Do you think you're going to be able to get that good of production in that part of the state?
Well, North Dakota has a good reputation with its wind resources, and the siting process and the wind measurement has now matured significantly over quite a number of years. So the reliance and the confidence that people put in those numbers today as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago is increased. So, and there's variability there. That's an expected average capacity factor. So,
but you feel pretty good about that number?
Yes, I would feel good about that number.
Fair enough.
And I would also defer to Greg to expand upon that from his.
No, we've seen over 50 on some acts that have been in production for a while, so it's not out of the realm. But just it's getting to be a very high number. Just a couple things. The decommissioning you talked about. What kind of costs did you figure for decommissioning, and how do you bookkeep that, if you will? Because we've struggled, or at least I've struggled, on how much money is needed to actually decommission these wind farms, because you don't know when it's going to be and what kind of cranes you're going to have. Is it $20 million? Is it $200 million? Just curious, what costs do you figure in?
Well, the estimates included in the model, I just got that information. So I believe it's $30 million. And then there's additional $4 million. Part of the $26 million is for the initial cost of the decommissioning, and $4 million would be applied to some preparatory years prior preparation for that.
Okay.
In just general terms.
And then how does that get paid for with ratepayer dollars, or how does that work as far as the where does that money come from? Is that something that the second that you start getting recouping costs, you start putting money into that $34 million? Or is that a rate case down the road where you come back?
It's included in the overall cost recovery framework of the project from the get-go.
Okay, so if 10 years from after you start producing electricity, you come back in front of the commission, you'll be able to have a piece of paper that says that you've already collected X amount of dollars, and it shouldn't be a problem to prove that?
My understanding is that is the process that's in place to do that over a period of time.
No, that's kind of what
it's included in the initial modeling and financial workup for the project.
Okay, and that's kind of what I thought, but we're having, like, for other companies that don't do this, they come back in and they have to show financial assurances and they have to go get that money from somewhere, so it's becoming it's a good thing what we're doing with this, but it's good the model you follow because it's easier, I think, to show those financial assets when the time is right. The turbine prices, you are absolutely correct. That becomes the ups and downs of all these wind farms. We go out and do a hearing on 1 point whatever, and they come back, and then we got to modify it to a 2 point whatever. So have you secured these turbines yet?
I would refer that to the progress update that Greg Ford will be providing.
The cost overruns in a project, is that for you to talk about or Greg?
Greg would talk about that.
Okay. Now, here's one I should have told Zev in the beginning, but I missed it in my notes. Are you familiar with whether there will be XL be participating in a habitat conservation plan and the associated risks now that you're going to own it if a whipping crane is hit?
I do not know the answer. That would also be Greg Ford as far as the project development.
Okay, and I'll just, for the rest of the crowd, that I cannot remember exactly if the company that was doing this is participating in the habitat conservation plan, but I know this is a big deal because it may not have been a big deal in my approval before because we're purchasing the power and the risk would have been to the owner of the project. But now since you're owning it, if that risk would become yours or ratepayers if something would happen, so we'll have to flush that out.
And I might add that Betsy Engelking may also, because her company did develop the project, she may have information on that as well, possibly.
Okay, and I want to get in more into the discussion about the cost of it. Just Mr. Hsu asked the questions, and you answered how this is a better deal now. So why did he even do a power purchase agreement in the first place? Why didn't he just build it in the first place if it's a better deal to own it?
Well, the cost that did come in, based on what was bid in, was extremely low, and it gave us at that time our mode of operation or preference at that point in time was PPA. It wasn't to own the facilities necessarily. We did provide that as an option.
But the cost that they bid in, they couldn't deliver.
Well, that was something that was a result of working through the contract implementation.
But I believe that's the skepticism I think that I heard, and for sure one of my colleagues and I agree with him on it. How should we know, looking forward at future PPPs, when they can't deliver them, and then you find yourself in this box now, it's a better deal than what the PPA was, but it couldn't be delivered anyway. I mean, it's hard for a regulator to understand the ins and outs here when this is so much cloak and dagger kind of stuff on cost, it seems. Not you guys so much, we can justify it, but I don't know. What are your thoughts to my rant there?
Well, that's why we work really hard to understand under due diligence and contract analysis and negotiations the strength of the counterparty, and we put provisions in those contracts to provide incentives to be able to perform and appropriate compensation and risk management through security, et cetera, to cover any deviation from that.
Okay. Maybe just this question, maybe. What makes this, I know you walked through the charts, but makes this a better deal to own this than the PPP did? What's the big thing that tips it your way now to own it?
Well, you get the full useful life of the project, which is beyond the 20-year term, 25 years,
and
who knows, maybe longer. Our cost of capital being lower is a big thing.
Your cost because you're a larger company that has access to?
Right, our financial situation being much stronger, ratings, et cetera. And our, very large company. So our cost of securing capital would be lower. That's a big incentive. So those are two main drivers, yeah.
So the full life, you'll be able to use it out until 20, 40, whatever, maybe even longer with retrofits?
Maybe even longer. Yeah, no one knows the life, the true life of some of these larger turbines, but they've been addressing issues with wind turbines and fixing them and modifying the technology regularly over the last 15 years. So.
Okay, and that's two points that make good sense to me. And one thing that, and Alana will correct me here, but one thing that's it's interesting is in a case for rebuttable presumption, Mr. Hsu and his crowd have to prove that you're wrong. They have to develop a strong case that shows that something is incorrect. So that's what really, I guess, makes this an easier lift for the company trying to build something in North Dakota. But thank you for highlighting those two points, and that's all the questions I have.
Chairman,
for you.
Thank you, Paul. Good to see you back here. I think you were the person to ask about the percent of wind farms or the number. It doesn't need to be exact that your company owns versus the PPAs. Can you speak generally about that?
Well, we have, I think, only several projects that we own, two or three that are actually owned and operated, and then there's a couple that are under construction right now. The rest, which are, we have about 119 PPAs. A lot of them are very small seabed projects and so forth. So there's a very small amount by comparison of number of contracts and projects that are owned currently.
Do you know the size of the projects that you own? And could you just kind of mention where they are?
I can tell you the size, but off the top of my, well, let's see, the ones that are under construction are Pleasant Valley, and that's southeastern Minnesota. There's also Odell. That's also in western Minnesota, and Odell is PPA, excuse me. Pleasant Valley will be owned by us, and then we have Borders up in North Dakota.
And remind me of the status of Borders. Is that in operation?
No, it's under
construction.
Yeah, construction. So is Pleasant Valley.
Okay. And the ones that are already operating, you said there's two or three?
Yeah, I don't have those off the top of my head. I apologize.
But I know, don't you have some in Colorado, some wind?
Yes, we do.
Are all those PPAs too?
I don't know the split of that. I think some are owned there, but most of them, again, are PPAs.
Okay. Do you happen to know how old the oldest owned one is? I'm just trying to get at the extent of your experience in owning versus going to
PPA. I can't recollect the exact age of the oldest owned one. I believe within the last 10 years.
Okay.
Within the last 10 years. I can just recollect from what I've seen on the data sheets.
Do you... on the PPAs, have you had any experience with them not delivering and actually having to kind of default on the actual PPA?
I'm not in the purchase power area of the company, so and my time with the company is only just over a year, so I don't really have a lot of history with that. So I can't speak to that
okay.
in terms of the law, you know, what's happened since we started doing PPAs.
All right. Then let's explore the worst-case scenario a bit, which is the 20-year, say, the potential 20-year life of the project. Because all the other scenarios are pretty rosy, so I just want to explore the potential worst-case scenario. What's your experience or your company's experience or your company's analysis of the likelihood that will or won't happen, the 20 years? What is the industry saying about the life of these projects?
What's usually looked at, because I do have experience working with the wind industry prior to coming with Xcel, and that's if you look at what you can insure and what people will secure in terms of the expected life of a facility. In the industry, it's very common to look at 25 years. So as far as life of the asset, the PPA term can vary from 10 years, 15, 20, and so forth.
Okay.
But as far as life of the asset, it's 25 years is very conventional. So to trim that back by 5 years, you're losing a substantial amount of output and benefit to spread those fixed costs and initial investment, as you can see by the sensitivity on the capacity mm-hmm. factor. So that's a big driver, is depriving the owner or the off-taker of that benefit of that additional 5 years is very significant.
Okay, but the manufacturer, do they give these a 25-year life?
They provide expectancy? A warranty. It's usually several years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can buy other contractual things that will provide things beyond that. But it's more of the due diligence on the technology and usually an independent entity that will assess that and give you an estimate as to what they think the technology is capable of in terms of expected life.
Mm-hmm. And that has been done for these, for this project, and it's 25 years?
As far as the specific study that has been done on that particular subject, I would defer to Greg Ford.
Okay. Greg, you're going to have lots of questions to answer. okay. What about the experience in the industry as a whole? Just are we seeing these last longer? I mean, it seems like wind is new, but already time goes fast. I bet there's some projects that are 15 years old already. And are they still going strong? Are we seeing any problems with the towers and the technology, I guess is what I'm asking? Failing sooner than expected.
I think things are getting better. If you look back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of problems with gearboxes from certain turbine suppliers. There was a lot of problems with the different approaches for manufacturing blades. And again, industry experience has been the school teacher there. Actually mm-hmm. getting them out there in an operating environment has provided substantial help over the last 10 to 15 years. So that current manufacturing and design has benefited from some of those earlier mistakes and challenges. So what's currently being produced is expected to have a much better operating profile. So.
Okay. I think I just have a couple more questions for you, and that is the table on page 14 of the application. Just tell me, you may not even need to pull it out, but can you tell me again what capital sensitivity 1 and capital sensitivity 2 are?
Your Honor, those numbers are trade secret.
I don't. Can you just generally tell me what is included in a capital sensitivity? What is it referred to?
Oh,
that's what I'm looking for.
I'm sorry. I just
yeah, not exactly what the numbers are.
The
yeah.
Okay. Capital sensitivity 1 and 2 refer to a higher cost for the project.
I see.
Two different higher tiers of cost for the project to see if. To address earlier questions on that.
I see.
Would it
okay.
still, even if the resulting cost were higher to step 1 or a step 2 higher, would it still be economic and a good deal? And
okay.
the answer to that is yes, based on our analysis.
I see that. Okay, sorry, I think you went through that with Mr. Hsu, but sometimes I'm still thinking about what was said last and I missed the next comment, which is what happened there, so apologize for that. Okay, and then on page 12 of your testimony, you looked at this graph with Mr. Hsu as well. It's the annual cost savings of company ownership. It jumps up when the PTC goes off, and then it starts falling again. And then in the year 2031, it looks like it drops. The cost drops significantly. What's causing that?
Well, this is... Again, this is evaluated against our system, and it mm-hmm. shows how this is performing against our system. And it's reflecting a change of units available or not being available in our system and how that adjusts to showing a savings or not a savings.
Okay.
So it's a reflection of changes in the generation mix.
So does something go – what do you suggest is happening there that makes it so much – more cost beneficial?
Would it be a unit retirements would affect that?
Okay. Something else coming offline? Is that like one of the coal units?
Probably, yes.
Is that when Sherco or one and two are coming
up? In this analysis, in this analysis, it would be reflective of a coal unit retirement.
Okay. All right. Let me just check my notes, make sure I'm not forgetting something here. Okay. I think I've covered it all. Thank you.
Mr. Christman.
Thank you. And since you didn't do your direct testimony, just turned it in. It was never covered, but just for people who might be listening that don't have any of the information, you're Director of Resource Planning and Bidding for XL, right? Okay. I'll just pick up where Commissioner Fedorchik left off on that chart on page 12. When the big jump in around 2027, that's the PTC.
Correct. 10-year period where you see the benefit of that and appreciation.
And then the drop 4 or 5 years later is what you were talking about would be the SHRCO?
Would be
a retirement.
A shift in the generation mix, yes.
Okay. So then out at 2042, what's that? It can't be another retirement because it goes the opposite way.
No, the study period only for this goes through 2040, and so ignore those last two dots.
Can you just elaborate, you know, when someone actually puts something on a sheet and then says ignore it?
No, I'm saying that the study period, and I apologize, the table really should have, or the chart really should have only covered the study period for the project that we evaluated, that we did not evaluate it beyond 2040. So it would be reflective of data and a database that is not relevant to, okay, to this analysis.
Okay. Started in the middle since you had been on that graph before. So now I want to jump all the way back, and I should have followed up with Ms. McCartan on this since it's a follow-up to one of her answers, but I'm sure you know the answer too. So she had said that this is not needed for capacity, but at lower energy costs. Is that a generalization, or is there any need for additional capacity that this fills, or is this completely a energy cost lowering maneuver?
There is energy benefit, and that's the primary driver of the economics, is the energy benefit, low cost energy of this project, and especially how it defers and displaces higher cost market purchases and fuel costs for the company. There is a capacity value of this in terms of, you know, how MISO would equate that, 14.8%, but because certain projects are not yet completed to secure the accreditation for this project until 2020, 2021, that capacity value is not reflected until that time frame.
But you expect that after that point it'll be 14.8?
That is correct.
Okay. And the energy that this will displace, the higher cost energy that this will displace, is that energy that XL generates that you will no longer have to generate, or is that purchased power or a combination?
It's a combination. We look at it two different ways, Commissioner, in terms of markets on, where it shows the benefit and the economics related to both the whole system, inclusive of what the market purchase opportunities might be, and we also look at it in terms of markets off, where it's just comparing it against our own owned and contracted resources.
Well, as the planner for XL, what would you expect will be the result? Will this displace mostly energy that you would have otherwise had to produce, or do you expect it'll mostly displace energy that you would have otherwise had to purchase?
Well, that will change over time based on the pricing of where the market goes over the next 15, 20 years for this particular project. So the amount of market purchase would vary over that period of time as far as the amount displaced.
But based on your expectations of where markets will be, what do you expect?
Well, I think we have very low cost generation. And I would say that it would be more of a market purchase displacement.
And for the operators from whom you purchase that power, would it be your planning expectation that they'll be able to find a different market for that power when you have wind generation, but still have theirs available when you need it? Or would you expect that they will just have less sales?
Well, that's controlled by MISO in terms of how they settle each day based on what's offered in and how they meet the need of the in real time. So the result of that is really controlled by them based on all the generation that's offered to the market.
It's controlled by them, but I'm trying to get to what... you're the expert here on how a whole generation and transmission and distribution system can work that can give me the best information possible. And I'm trying to figure out what you expect will happen here.
Over time, you're going to see a change in the mix between how much is used off of our system versus the market at large. And that will depend on the changing generation pricing as more gas units come on. Some coal retires, so the economics of that dispatch and where each of those resources are in that stack based on the price that they're being offered into the market, that will shift over time. Currently, we would expect utilization of our resources based on load increasing and the demands of MISO in general would increase over time. So better utilization of our resources.
So when you plan, you know, beyond a couple of years, but out 20 or 25 years, for something that's going to displace other sources, what do you use to calculate in the additional cost of those other sources at the times when you need them because of the fact that their sales just aren't going to be the same as if you had been using them consistently all the time?
Well, in terms of long-term planning, we make snapshot assumptions today based on the best forecast of prices that drive the economics of the energy supply system long-term, whether it be gas prices, capital costs for those generation units, both existing and those that are selected to fill a need, either capacity or energy that we would own or contract for. And that's as we've submitted to you, that's what the resource plan actually pulls together and provides that picture.
Wouldn't your resource plan require you to come up with some firm projection, knowing that, I mean, it's going to be off some, but some kind of estimate of how much more your baseload is going to cost when you lessen the need for it by using intermittent sources? And we just know there's certain fixed costs that are going to have to cause the prices for the baseload sources to go up when you don't use them all the time.
Right, and our modeling does do that. It shows variation and the influence on all of our generation resources in terms of reduced capacity factor on coal, say, for instance.
Okay. I know I could look back at the siting, but how many turbines are involved in Courtney?
I don't recall off right off the top of my head.
102 megawatts.
200.
Okay. So the estimate of the, whether it's 26 or 30 million for decommissioning, how did you come up with that?
I will get the decommissioning cost estimate. I will defer to Greg Ford on that.
Okay, that's where the rest of my questions are, so thank you.
Mr. Sensor? Yeah. Chairman Fedorchak,
just one.
Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify that the way I understand the
you'll bid this into the MISO market every day. And some days you'll use it, and some days somebody else might get the power. Is that right? You'll bid this resort into the MISO every day.
Correct.
So you're going to get something out of MISO every day, whether you're is a must-run resource. There's going to be money coming XL's way every day that wind is blowing. Well, I understand it.
You'll get the settled price for that resource on that day. Yes.
And some days it'll be a good deal for you, and some days it'll be a really good deal for you, depending what's needed out in other states.
Yeah, and as stated in the testimony by Victor, he did provide that range for 2014, and so it could be as high as over $300
right.
per megawatt hour.
Thank you.
Chairman Fedorchuk.
Just one more discussion again on the owning versus PPAs. When it's so clear in this case, in this analysis, that the owning is so much more beneficial from a cost standpoint, why don't you own more? Why doesn't the company choose? You've got 119 PPAs and just a handful of projects that you own. Now, I realize some of those PPAs are small, but if it's it seems so clear-cut that ownership is more beneficial. Why don't you own more?
One of the main reasons, Commissioner Chair, is that our tax capacity for the PTC is limited at this point in time. So to take ownership, then we would be looking for having adequate tax capacity to benefit, take the full benefits of the PTC. So that's limited our ownership.
I see. Preference. Okay. And then there's one other question that it should be referred to Greg, but it's the discussion on the federal PTC and securing that in the status. Tell me what you have in place today to ensure, it says here that Geronimo has met, and the Courtney project has met a number of the thresholds required by the IRS for proving that you qualify for the PTC, even, you know, if you don't meet that January 1st requirement, which is your first goal of 2017. Can you explain what it is that you have that assures that? What have you done? What has the project done that assures that it's going to qualify for the PTC?
I think you're correct, and that would be something that Greg would be
okay.
able to address with his progress update on the project, or even Betsy Engelking as well.
Okay, thank you. That's it for me.
Mr. Simpson, any redirect?
Yes, Your Honor, a little bit. Just to talk about the history of this project, this was part of four projects that were selected as part of the RFP, correct?
That is correct.
And that selection was made because the pricing was the best that the company had seen for quite some time?
That is correct.
And that selection of four projects, was that both PPA and company owned?
Yes, it was.
And those were split two and two, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And as the resource planner for NSP, is it your opinion that if the company didn't own this project, that this project just wouldn't happen?
That is what I'm led to believe based on the information, yes.
So is it also fair to look at this project not just in contrast to the PPA, but as sort of its absolute cost savings that it might provide to customers?
Yes, absolutely.
And does Table 1 show that in your page 14 of the application? Table 1 and Table 2?
Yes.
And can you walk us through Table 2 and what that shows as far as just cost savings of moving forward with this project, regardless if we had a PPA or not?
Yes, this is compared to our system, the benefits against our system, that based on current pricing of the owning, that Courtney, it's $97 million benefit on the base case. With even a low gas assumption, you're still saving $50 million. The high gas, it bumps up to almost $160 million savings. Very significant. if you did have the benefit of the market purchases at large, it still would net out at $72 million benefit. A 30-year operating life, given, you know, how all that production, all that benefit on a fixed cost asset like what we would have, bumps it up to $106 million. 20-year operating life, again, that's very sensitive to that 5 years less of operation, it's $20 million. If you increase that capacity factor by 5% increase, it's $143 million, significant benefit. Again, the sensitivity to that, if you dropped it 5%, $66 million. The capital cost, where we have substantial cost increase in terms of two sensitivities, you still net out at $80 million with the first tier of increased costs and still preserve, even at a higher cost, $63 million benefit. And then depending upon the adjustment of the long-term ongoing capital investment in O&M, if you increase that by 25%, you net out at $76 million benefit. And if you were to decrease that by 25%, it would be $117 million. So against, without this project, we're really not having these benefits that could otherwise be realized by our customers, including, of course, those in North Dakota. So we see it as a very beneficial project.
And Mr. Johnson, the cost savings that you achieve under, it looks like every scenario that we've studied at this point, this is really offsetting the variable costs of other generation sources. Is that correct?
Yes.
And can you help explain how that actually works?
Well, wind is offered in as a treated as a must run, and then the thermal units are usually are filling around that, whether they be gas or coal, and so the more wind you have produced at X price, it will eliminate the need to generate coal and gas-based generation and the associated cost of that.
And the associated cost of coal and gas generation, that's not just the cost of fuel, but also the variable cost of operating the plant, correct?
Yep.
And by foregoing those variable costs, are you at all lessening the value of the installed capacity you have from those plants?
No.
You were asked about the purchasing of a distressed asset, and I just want to clarify for the record, the distressed asset, we didn't actually purchase any physical assets from Geronimo, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so there's nothing, it's not a smashed up car that we're buying and fixing up. Thank you. Nothing further, Your Honor.
Shoe?
Nothing additional, Your Honor.
We have one question, but I was just going to ask you to explain, but at the fourth grade level for my benefit, how your estimated decommissioning costs are recovered through the depreciation or reflected in the depreciation reserve accounts. Can you explain the concept of that for the record, please?
You didn't use fourth grade words even in your in your question, Lana. At least my fourth grader doesn't talk about depreciation.
He likes cold free dig, though.
Yes, he does.
I'm not familiar with the details of that recovery for the decommission.
Is the next witness?
We don't have a rates expert, but maybe I can help Mr. Johnson walk through how that would work.
Okay with me if it's no objection to you testifying.
He's done a fair amount of it.
The secret's out. Mr. Johnson, it's correct to note that the decommissioning costs are included in your modeling and the cost, and so that would be reflected in the rate impact that you present in your testimony. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And is it your understanding that when the company calculates the actual depreciation costs? Well, let's go back one. When a plant goes into service, the company takes an expense for the depreciation of that plant. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that depreciation is set on a number of factors, correct?
That is correct.
And is it your understanding that when the company calculates its depreciation costs, it also includes the cost of the decommissioning so that it can collect all of its decommissioning costs as part of the depreciation expense of the plant?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing further, Your Honor.
One thing nice about leading questions is it really gets the information into the record a lot faster. Mr. Hsu, any follow-up?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, thank you.
Okay. Any more questions from the commissioners for Mr. Johnson? Do we want to take a little break right now?
Okay. Judge, if I might just make one comment before we break. Since there's not a lot of members of the public here, I just want to take 1 second to introduce one member of the public who came, just so everybody isn't wondering who it is. But Mel Schlittenhart is sitting in the front row, and she is a university. She's a nurse practitioner in Bismarck practicing, and she's also a graduate student at UMary working on her doctorate degree. And one of the classes she's taken is some sort of a leadership class. So while she spends her days treating and caring for people, today she's having a little bit of torture having to sit to a regulatory hearing on energy policy because she has to follow some other leaders in town. And she chose me, which is a little humbling for me, but Mel and I are friends as well. So she's watching our hearing today and going to be around the office. So just wanted to point her out. Sorry, Mel. But I know everyone's probably going, I wonder who that is.
When she came in the room, I was wondering if she was going to have a lot of questions.
Yeah, see? All right. Anyway.
Okay, let's take a break till about 5 after 10.
Yeah, so it's like a trial practice.
Yes, yes, thank you.